Coming up on Tech Nation, I speak with Gary Shapiro, the longtime president and CEO of the Consumer Electronics Association, about what's happening with tech innovation in the United States and worldwide. We'll talk about his book, Ninja Innovation, which is now out in paperback. Then on Biotech Nation, it's all about using viruses and bacteria to deliver treatments for everything from Ebola to rare juvenile diseases such as Sanfilippo and Batten disease to Fanconi anemia. All this coming up on this week's Tech Nation.
Let's take five with Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
Last week's 5 Minutes about fraudulent software, starting with the masking of diesel engine emissions by Volkswagen and moving on to the story of the robot that wouldn't start following the exit of a prominent engineer, made me realize that the fraud isn't perpetrated by the technology. That's just a vehicle. Fraud is perpetrated by people. I was managing a team of people at NASA, and we were working on a computer program which modeled the climate of the Earth. It was a complex program to be developed on a large government scientific computer with many computer processors all operating in parallel. To feed the scientific computer, we wrote another program on another computer to enable us to load up the big scientific computer with data and download and examine the results at the end. We started with known weather of the world at an earlier date, ran the model for some number of virtual days, and then downloaded the result. If the model worked, the result would match the actual weather of the world that same number of days later. The team of some 8 programmers worked on the model and the front-end program for well over a year. And suddenly, we were getting results, good results, and it was time to present to NASA management, which we did, receiving great accolades and resounding applause. I remember the room. I remember the people. I even remember the chairs and the morning light and the slides. We'd done a good job. We did what we set out to do. Afterward, I gave the whole team T-shirts to mark the occasion and took them out to lunch at a local restaurant. When we had ordered, there I was, sitting at the head of the long table and getting ready to make a laudatory speech when I realized everyone was looking at me, and then looking at the fellow to my left, then looking back at me, and then him again. Nobody was talking. Then I looked at him and realized he was simply looking at me. So I said, okay, what's wrong? The fellow to my left told me a long story about how he and his wife would drive to Mexico every year on vacation. And one time he had scored some really good weed, and he wanted to take it back with them. So he put it in the hubcap of his spiffy little sports car, and he and his wife drove north, back across the border, into the U.S. And it wasn't until they got well into California that he told his wife about the weed and how he had smuggled it across the border, and she predictably fell apart. Besides being upset, she asked him, "Why didn't you tell me?" And he said, "Because if you knew, you would have given the whole thing away when we crossed the border." And then he stopped and he looked at me. I said, "Why are you telling me this story?" And he looked me straight in the eye and said, "Because the program doesn't work." Fraud comes in all sorts of packages, in all kinds of ways, sometimes in secret, sometimes out in the open, but always, always to the shock of those who don't see it coming. And for those who perpetrate it, they're an alien breed among us, and they never do it just once. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
5 Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancour.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, I speak with Gary Shapiro, the president and CEO of the Consumer Electronics Association, about tech innovation in the United States and worldwide. Then on Biotech Nation, we talk about using viruses and bacteria as treatments for everything from Ebola to rare juvenile diseases. Gary Shapiro is the longtime president and CEO of CEA, the Consumer Electronics Association, and he's the author of Ninja Innovation. Gary, welcome back to Tech Nation.
It's such an honor to be back here. I had so much fun last time.
Well, last time we talked about Ninja Innovation, and I got to tell you, since then, I have gone totally ninja. You know, I have all those little sayings in the book, like, not bound by precedent, have to invent new ways, ninjas never settle. You really got me going here.
That is so great to hear. I'm glad I've affected someone, and actually someone as wonderful
just
as you.
Just one person, me. Well, I have a feeling it's been a lot more because you're now out in paperback, and you've had a year or so now. I can't remember when you came in, a year and a half maybe. So people have been, you know, adopting Ninja, taking your Ninja, your little black squeezing Ninja, which is, you know, really adorable. Actually, maybe he's fierce. He's not adorable. And you must have gotten some feedback and some reactions from people about Ninja Innovation.
I do get a lot of reactions, and it's positive. We are a ninja nation. That's what we are. We're people that we reinvent ourselves. We do things differently. And that's kind of what our nation does. We're leaders of the digital economy. We do so many different things using the internet and that just didn't exist 20 years ago. Look at Uber, for example, how we get around and what we do. And that's all in a few years. We've reinvented and we're reinventing the world. A lot of our best companies are taking their story worldwide.
Well, I have to say, you know, our show airs worldwide and we have listeners coming in from every direction. And innovation is happening all over the world.
Yes, it is happening all over the world. There are pockets of innovation in France, in Israel, in Eastern Europe. Even China is working really hard to be innovative. We just had an event there, CES Asia, and there was some really interesting things Chinese companies are doing. I mean, they have a very long way to go because it's a nation where innovation is not part of their normal culture. It is part of our culture. That's what we do. We challenge the status quo. We're an immigrant nation. We're very diverse. And we do so many things because we have it in our blood to ask questions.
Well, let's, you know, we got CES in Asia. Let's go back and explain to anyone who doesn't know, the four people out there, what CES in Las Vegas each year is, because it's a huge show.
Well, CES is the largest innovation event in the world. It attracts over 150,000 people to Las Vegas. It's trade only. You get over 6,000 journalists and 50,000 people from outside the United States. And they see, well, nobody sees it all, but there are 3,600 companies exhibiting. And there's also almost 1,000 speakers and keynoters and fabulous stuff. And that is what CES is about. It's getting people from different industries even together. So it's the broadcast, motion picture, cable, satellite, automobile. All these different industries converge, and that's what's changed dramatically in just about 10 years or so, is that to succeed in business today, you have to go outside of your box, be a ninja, cross over to another industry, and cut a deal. That's why when you start up your car, you see so many different brands and features and electronics in there, or when you're introducing a new product or using a smartphone, it has so many different apps and things that are created with other different brands. What we're really good at and is doing deals, is building teams, and that's what I think is business school has some value, is that you're teaching teamwork and you're teaching people to get along with each other. And that's what our diverse culture is really good at. Although we're very self-critical how we don't get along, actually we get along remarkably well with all the different people we have from around the world. It's the biggest melting pot there is.
Well, if you haven't been to CES, it's almost shocking. My producers, of course, set me up. They said, hey, come over here. And they said, don't let this car hit you. Well, of course, it was a driverless car. I was like, oh, excuse, wait a minute. There's nobody to apologize. Apologize to. That was not good. You know, at the same time, you looked around, all of these cars were doing all kinds of things. They were parallel parking. They were, I mean, it's amazing to me how many automobile manufacturers are working on not only driverless cars, but augmented driving so you don't have to do it yourself.
Absolutely. And that's what where we're heading towards is a driverless car. It'll be phenomenally life-changing in terms of how we have fewer people will be killed and injured, lives will be changed. We'll need auto insurance companies are going to have to think of a different line of work, tow truck operators, emergency room people. It's going to be hugely disruptive in a positive way, but for some people in a negative way because it'll affect their jobs and their businesses. But think of it. Today, if you want to buy something, you have two choices. You could go to a store, or you could order it by phone or online, and it'll be delivered to you by a delivery truck. We'll have three more ways in the future. We'll have that driverless car. We'll come to your home and drop it off. Or we'll have a drone coming by your house and dropping it off. All, or you'll have a 3D printer. You can make it at home once you get the
download
information.
Nobody even has to come. You just say print it out.
Well, that's what happened on a space station a few months ago when one of their tools broke. Instead of waiting a few months for the next delivery up there, they used their 3D printer to make the tool they needed. Or the 3D printer is being used now in third world countries for kids with missing limbs or hands, and they want to have it grow with them. Instead of, they can't afford to have a new limb. That's the traditional way, but 3D printers allowed it to come down in cost. It's changed our lives. 3D printers are being used now for not only little plastic replacement buttons and parts, but it's being used to create cars and even houses. It's being used to, for rapid prototyping, but it's used in baking today because sugar is a meltable substance. We are going to proceed soon with other substrates, so it'll be cooking. It'll be everything in the home in the next, I don't know how many years, but we are getting there. Just as with a driverless car, we're going to active collision avoidance at this point. I was driving my wife's car over the weekend, and I was driving over 30 miles an hour, and I intentionally drifted out of the lane. It pulled me back and vibrated the wheel. This is happening very, very quickly, and it is transformational in so many different ways. And we see at CES, we see the driverless cars from almost every major car manufacturer. We're seeing, of course, 3D printing. That's doubled in size. And the same with the drones, or the more polite unmanned aerial vehicles, because the drones that kill people, we're not involved in that at all. But the drones that are being used by consumers to video themselves or see, or by farmers to see their crops or to inspect buildings, that is a huge, growing, rapidly growing market.
Well, I was shocked to see in the last show, there was like 500 drone manufacturers. There were drones everywhere. It was like, look up. And it was shocking to see how many people could be working on it just because, you know, it's like in the old days, if you had a complex technology like that, you might get a couple of people in on the deal. There were many, many small companies as well as large companies who were working on this technology.
Well, because it has so many real applications which will save lives. If you want to bridge inspect it or you want to look at your crops, it rather than send planes aboard or helicopters or actually people climbing bridges, you could do so much safer, cheaper and more accurately with a programmed drone videotaping, maybe using infrared, maybe using some other technology. The business applications are absolutely huge. Or they're being used now for missing children. A drone was used to deliver a life jacket to a kid stuck in a raging river. Drones have real-world commercial applications. They're being used to deliver medicine in third-world countries to get past that last impassable mile up beyond muddy roads. And you could daisy-chain the drone. So they go out and they come back and they recharge in chargers and then they just keep going. So the distance could be many miles now for a drone to go and drop something off like some very quickly needed drugs and come back. I envision a world where you'll have rooftop-to-rooftop drone deliveries in cities, so you'll relieve some congestion on lower down in the streets.
For everyone who is standing there going, look at this technology, this is so neat, there also is that little part of them that says, gee, am I going to have a job? Am I going to have a job? You must be challenged about that daily.
I think about that daily because it is true that we are going to cost jobs, just as taxi cab drivers are seeing the impact from Uber. But generally, I think when we have lost jobs for the last 100, 200 years as a country to overseas or things like that or technology, it's been for better jobs. 200 years ago, you and I would have been on a farm somewhere, or even worse, maybe, you know, working 12 hours a day at some horrible factory job, risking our lives and limb. As Americans, with our education, frankly, we don't want a lot of those jobs, and we can't do them. But what we have seen is a remarkable creation of new jobs and new skills. There's a tremendous shortage of data analysts now, of people who are trained in STEM, of electronics, of software designers. You go into the Detroit marketplace now, where I actually spend a lot of my time, my family is there, and all I hear is how all the auto companies need software engineers. They have so many jobs open. And frankly, believe it or not, truck drivers. There's a shortage of jobs in this country. There's over 3 million jobs that are open today that cannot be filled. It's just we have to retrain. We have to figure out what people are good at. And maybe in the future, the far future, we'll have more leisure time to do other things that are constructive, to volunteer. We have an aging population that's going to need people helping them. There's no question about that. And even the best,
driverless car can't do everything.
It can't do everything. A driverless car cannot get the older person's luggage and place it in the car for them. That's not going to happen in my lifetime. So we are still going to need people helping people on a one-on-one basis. And we have a shortage of those people now, especially with this population having Alzheimer's, getting older, and we have no plan in place for it.
Well, ninjas can reinvent themselves nimbly, and that means everybody. I mean, it's like you thought you had your career, you went to school, you did all that stuff. It's like you've got to continually reinvent yourself, and you got to make sure you've got skills, I don't care what age you are, for this age and for this upcoming age.
I totally agree with that, Maura. I think that every student should think about what they're studying and whether it's going to help them be prepared, whether it's data analyst skills, science and math, or frankly, people skills, which are so needed. If your nose is always stuck in your device and you can't look someone in the eye and talk to them or shake their hand or have conversation, I encourage kids to challenge yourself when you're with someone. Ask them questions. Learn about them. You could always learn something from somebody. And that's what ninjas do. They take on any experience and they turn it to something valuable, which will help them grow or help someone else grow. And that is where we have a long ways to go, I think, culturally and dealing with this great vastness of technology, which I love. But technology should never replace the human element. Just the way you and I are looking at each other as we're talking, or we have a trade show as big as ours, where we could do a lot of it electronically with webs and telepresence and things like that. People want to see people. They want to have that five-sense experience, look each other in the eye, evaluate the person. They also want to be inspired. And also there's the value of serendipity, which is so important. You have to open yourself up for something totally new. Think outside your box and broaden your horizons.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Gary Shapiro. He's the longtime president and CEO of the Consumer Electronics Association, which produces CES each year in January in Las Vegas. You likely remember him from his book, Ninja Innovation, The 10 Killer Strategies of the World's Most Successful Businesses. While we usually think of finished products or about-to-be-released products to see at CES, there's also a lot of support for early-stage companies, early innovation, mid-stage innovation. That's taken a new direction there as well.
We've always run the trade show for the smallest company, the startup in a garage, someone with an idea that they could have access to 150,000 people from around the world, the investors, the retailers, the media like yourself, to be inspired. In fact, we've created a separate area of the show called Eureka Park, which was just starting out with just a handful of companies. Now it's over 400 companies we'll have, and they must be a startup. We subsidize it. And boy, do they do well there. Every one of them, 100% of them, are overwhelmed with ideas and other partners and investors. Mark Cuban's walked around there and made $1 million investment. Walmart's placed orders there. It's really the most exciting part of the show because you are dealing with people who are scientists and with an idea, or just they come from around the world, and it's inspiring actually. And what they come up with is really clever. And it's something that we feel we have an obligation to do, is to make sure that this is not expensive for them. So for just about $1,000 or so, they have 4 days of drinking out of a fire hose of ideas and feedback. And what they're doing is good, they'll get a lot of input. And if it's not good and it needs to be changed, they get that input as well. Because the biggest thing about startups is you don't need a lengthy business plan. What you need is to test your concept with real potential customers and investors and retailers, and they'll give you feedback, and then you adjust. And, you know, there's a saying, fail fast, That's what entrepreneurs have to do. You have to fail fast and adjust. And that's what ninjas do as well.
Look around. There's ninjas all around. I feel it. I could feel it here. But that's such a good point. You know, here we are in Silicon Valley, and it's like it takes a lot to get in front of a techie. It takes a lot to get in front of a venture capitalist. It takes a lot. And it's like that's few and far between. But you're in the soup of it for four solid days, you know, 12, 15 hours a day. You can't get that anyplace.
Well, that's why I think live events are so important. Our trade show or other events where you're getting a lot of people who are interested in a category of what you're doing will give you immediate feedback that you can't get anywhere else.
Now, let's go back to CES Asia. Now, how big is that compared to the big Las Vegas show?
Well, it's certainly tremendously smaller. We'll be entering our 50th year in a couple of years.
50 years of CES shows?
Yes.
Wow.
But the Asia show was one of the largest startups ever. It's over 100,000 square feet. It had over 200 exhibitors. 30,000 people attended, over 1,000 press. And it was fantastic. I mean, that Chinese market is amazing. It is hot. And, of course, Shanghai is the only place in China for it. It just has everything there. The international airport. And we saw a lot of Chinese entrepreneurship. We did limit the participation in the show to just those that have great brands or great innovations. We didn't want 60 types of smartphone cases in it. We wanted something that's different. And there is innovation going on. It is exciting. It's a different environment. But China is still fast growing. It's still the largest nation by any measure on the earth. In fact, China will have more English speakers than the United States does. If not now, it will soon.
Now, how did you deal with the languages? You had Chinese, you had English. How did that all work?
We have Chinese partners. We have Chinese speaking staff. And we also did, we had little devices when the speeches are given that went to the language of preference for the listener.
So you managed. You learned a lot, one big show.
We have international events and we deal with different languages. You know, when we're promoting the CES worldwide, we do it in about a dozen different languages as well. And we have interpreters and we have signage and we have ways of, you know, English is the language of business. We're very blessed or we're spoiled, depending on your perspective for that as Americans. But the reality is we have to be a little more cultural accommodating when we're doing businesses with our friends from overseas. Remember, we only have 5% of the consumers in the world in our country, and we have to accommodate the other 95% if we want to survive as business people.
Let's get back to the drones, because I'm constantly seeing popping up in various places proposed legislation and, you know, at every level. I mean, you can't have this legislation, number one, at all these different places and all these different levels because they're going to run into each other. And number two, we don't even really know what the technology is yet. It's really early. So it's tough to make legislation on something you don't quite understand yet.
That is the biggest challenge we face in the innovation world, is that well-meaning government bureaucrats and legislators want to solve a problem that they perceive exists when it doesn't even really exist yet, and they could choke off innovation. We saw it with the efforts to ban the VCR, and we saw it already. We're seeing it with drones. I mean, the FAA has been very slow to allow drones, so great companies like Amazon and Intel have had to go over outside the United States to Canada and elsewhere to test drones. We want to be the leader in drones, and we should be, and there's a lot of great American companies doing things. But our federal government has been very, very slow to respond. Congress, fortunately, is being a little more deliberative. They're having discussions about it, and they're asking to learn about it. California, the legislature just popped out with some crazy legislation, which thankfully Governor Brown vetoed recently. And that would have basically allowed any private person to stop drone use over the land at a very high level. What we have to do is be reasonable. Look, of course, drones should not go real high when there's planes around. They should stay away from airports, and they should have all sorts of restrictions on them. And that we're developing voluntarily. We have done that. And technology is evolving quickly, which allows drones to avoid each other and other things. And so we're going to get there. But when airplanes were first introduced, there was a principle law that you owned everything above your land to the sky. And it went all the way up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court said, you do not own the sky. And that allowed planes to fly around. And we're starting to face some of the same thing with drones. But the federal government is pretty powerful in this area. And the FAA is a little slow moving and very frustrating, frankly, to a lot of drone manufacturers, which are doing their testing outside the United States.
Let's talk about Uber and Lyft and Airbnb and all of these economies that have come up because of the internet and the ability to charge and tell people where you are. And I mean, a million things you're able to do. These are whole new economic models. These aren't just Uber, Lyft, and Airbnb.
Absolutely. So we have many companies that are part of our organization which are focused on the new economy, the sharing economy, the economy where you buy something and you can share it, whether it's your home, your tools, your car, your bicycle, you name it. There are new models being created, which actually are very green. They allow less things to be built in a sense because they're being shared. I mean, the average car sits empty 95% of the time. So if you want to make some money off and use it, or you want to have like your truck, there's business models allowing people to basically show up with their truck and then deliver stuff quickly, like the Uber model. That's a good thing. In a sense, that allows more people to buy trucks, but it also means there'll be fewer of them on the road as well. And that's a good thing because I think people are making money that way. My brother makes his mortgage payments by Airbnb, and I use Airbnb. I love it. Uber is something which every Uber driver I've ever talked to, it's not their full-time job. They're either retired, they want to meet people, or they need some spare money and they have a job that doesn't pay. So this is what America is about. It's about innovation. It's about people doing directly business with each other without the government getting involved. Now, of course, the government has a role here. The role of a government with Uber, for example, is to make sure they're insured, they're good drivers, things are safe. Same thing with homes. Should those people renting out their homes pay taxes? Absolutely. Of course they should. And we need basic protections, but we don't need protections against other people's business models.
For a couple of years now, we've heard the Internet of Things, IoT, and it's like anything that's a thing can be connected. Are we just kind of there? It's like it's all done. We're all connected. If you build something, it's got to be connected.
The Internet of Things is a complex description of something which is really very simple. Is it products, little tiny components like light bulbs and your garage door opener and things like that are all connected with each other through the internet. And it all comes to the fact that these little sensing devices are very cheap. They use very little electricity and they could have internet addresses. So the question is what you do with it. And very clever people around the world, innovators, are saying, hey, if you could do this, if your seat that you sit in could have a device in it that tells you that you're getting sick, or your car could tell you that you're about to go off the road and hit someone, which is more complex, then we'll save lives, we'll help things, we'll make people better. And this is solving, like, can your plants tell you they need water? This is going to help agriculture. It's going to help clean water. It's going to help end the hunger. We're going to figure out what diseases are being caused and how to avoid them. All this data analysis is very, very good.
I'm speaking with Gary Shapiro, the president and CEO of the Consumer Electronics Association and the author of Ninja Innovation. We'll talk more after a break. Podcasts of Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are available at iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcast syndication outlets. Coming up in the second half of our show on Biotech Nation, it's viruses and bacteria, all used in treatments for everything from Ebola to Fanconi anemia. Stay with us. You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm speaking with Gary Shapiro, the president and CEO of the Consumer Electronics Association and author of Ninja Innovation.
These little sensing devices are very cheap. They use very little electricity, and they could have internet addresses. So the question is what you do with it. And very clever people around the world, innovators, are saying, hey, if you could do this, if your seat that you sit in could have a device in it that tells you that you're getting sick, or your car could tell you that you're about to go off the road and hit someone, which is more complex, then we'll save lives, we'll help things, we'll make people better. And this is solving, like, can your plants tell you they need water? This is going to help agriculture. It's going to help clean water. It's going to help end hunger. We're going to figure out what diseases are being caused and how to avoid them. All this data analysis is very, very good. Now, what we have to sort through are issues like privacy. It's like the HIPAA things with medicine. Some things are really private. Some things are not private at all. For example, a lot of us wear these little devices on our wrists that measure how much we sleep, our heartbeat, our steps. Now, when there's an earthquake, if we want to know immediately how far that earthquake has gone, you know what? Collectively, that data can, within a matter of minutes, we could figure out how far the earthquake went, what its intensity, where people felt it. That's great information to have. We could tell by windshield wipers going on cars where precisely it's raining. We could get weather information that way immediately. There's a lot of things which really have nothing to do with privacy, and this is good information we'll collect. But there'll be other things, and people a lot smarter than me are figuring out all sorts of cool ways to deal with this information, which will really make our lives better, we'll be healthier, safer, and more educated.
So there's two levels here at least. One is you just have to hook up everything that people, you know, create the data. And the second is, what does it tell us? How can we use it in really good ways that, as you say, doesn't really violate your privacy?
Absolutely. So we're starting to get like an amazing amount of information. So for the, not only there's devices, but there's programs where you put in what you have eaten and then what the health results are, and it becomes almost automatic and electronic. Gathering millions of pieces of information on that, and then the health implications. You could draw all sorts of correlations between what's good for you, what's bad for you, what type of person you are. This is going to go towards very specialized type of treatments and medicines and diets and things like that. This amount of information is expanding the bounds of human knowledge in a way which will make our lives better, healthier, safer. And of course, there are other sides to it. There's a privacy issue. There's all sorts of things. But we're going to deal with those. We're going to have discussions about those. And we're going to do it in a way which is intelligent, which will better mankind.
Gary, thanks so much for coming in. Come back anytime.
Oh, I love being here, and I love talking to you.
My guest today is Consumer Electronics Association President Gary Shapiro. His book, Ninja Innovation, is now out in paperback. It's published by William Morrow. I'm Moira Gunn. You're listening to Tech Nation. The world we know is changing. Welcome to Biotech Nation. Today on Biotech Nation, we talk about using viruses and bacteria in treatments for everything from Ebola to rare juvenile diseases such as Sanfilippo and Batten disease to Fanconi anemia. 2014 brought us the Ebola crisis. Dr. Ripley Ballou is head of clinical research and translational science at GSK. I asked him, what part was GSK able to play?
GSK Vaccines was contacted by the WHO in late August of 2014 to ask whether we could dramatically accelerate the development of a vaccine that we were working on for Ebola in the background, and we were able to take that request and turn it into a very accelerated development program that led to our ability to actually start a phase 3 trial by February, just a few months later.
Which is really unusual.
Considering that the vaccine was in preclinical development in August to go into the clinic, first time in human, identify a dose, get some initial safety data, and then propose to participate in a very large phase 3 trial in 5 months is essentially unheard of in this business.
What does your vaccine propose to do?
Well, it's a...
Did you see how I said that? That yeah. Proposed to do, because you have to really make sure it does it. That's what phase 3 is about.
Exactly. It's a prophylactic vaccine. In other words, it's meant to prevent people from becoming infected and getting sick with Ebola. And it does this by virtue of inducing an immune response against the surface protein on the outside that coats the Ebola virus, and that interferes with the ability of the virus to infect cells.
So it's a traditional vaccine, as we would think.
Absolutely. What's not traditional about it is the way it's made and its delivery system. We're using new technology that's based upon it's called an adenovirus, which is another type of virus that has been inactivated so that it can't reproduce in the body, but we can grow it up in a fermenter, for example. And we insert into that adenovirus a piece of the Ebola virus that allows the body to make an immune response against Ebola with, of course, not becoming infected with Ebola.
Not really having Ebola, just exactly. Sort of this Ebola-like engineered virus.
It's a cold virus. It essentially causes a cold-like illness in its wild type, but we have inactivated that so that it doesn't make people sick, but it does trigger an immune response against the Ebola virus.
Well, from your perspective, I mean, what have we learned from the Ebola situation in 2014?
I think the single biggest learning is that the world is not prepared to take on an emerging threat like this. We were very fortunate that Ebola did not spread outside of West Africa. I mean, there were certainly limited cases that were imported, but we dodged a bullet on this one, and certainly there are a number of other disease threats that are much more transmissible than Ebola. And I'm thinking about MERS, for example, which has caused a big scare in Korea recently, which does appear to be more transmissible from person to person than Ebola is, which requires Ebola, you have to have direct contact with a patient that's infected, whereas you can just be around somebody with MERS and the virus is transmitted by aerosol, and therefore people can
get
sick.
In the same room.
This is what's happening
good.
In the hospital.
Yeah.
But the world and vaccine industry in general is not putting the development of vaccines against potential emerging rare diseases as a priority because the markets are uncertain, the development pathways are uncertain, the regulatory approval process is uncertain, and it's not clear who actually wants these vaccines, who will stockpile them, who will supply them. There's no policy around how they would be used, and this really adds a big so much uncertainty around the development process that industry has been reluctant to get involved in this. And we think we need to rethink how we're doing this.
Well, understanding that the World Health Organization, the WHO, is a global organization, it's still a separate organization. It's a non-governmental organization. And we have all the players, the pharmaceutical companies, the vaccine companies that can produce this. We have all the nations that are involved. I mean, this is a big group to get to interact on things and come together.
I think the experience around Ebola was actually very promising in that regard, in that there was very rapidly a lot of dialogue, discussion. The WHO has great convening authority and was able to bring actors together and to do some amazing things around accelerating the development of these vaccines. But this was not business as usual, and the WHO was stretched to its limits in the process of doing this. And I think that we've seen calls for rethinking about how the WHO is organized in terms of its ability to respond to these kinds of threats in the future.
Now, this takes us to the whole question of where vaccines are going in general. What's next for vaccines?
I think we're going to see vaccines becoming available for targets that we previously thought were not very accessible. And by targets, I mean diseases and populations. And for example, we have at GSK, we have a vaccine that is targeting a disease called shingles caused by a herpes zoster virus. And we've recently completed a phase 3 trial that's shown a remarkable level of efficacy. And it's due to the use of new technologies that we've been working on for the last decade or so, but are really showing that we can, for example, go into a population, an elderly population, that doesn't respond well to vaccines, and by using this adjuvant technology, really change the game. And we're seeing very high levels of efficacy, and we're hoping to have these data reviewed by the FDA in the next year and a half or so.
So you're getting better, faster, cheaper, are you?
We're working on it. The better, yeah, faster cheaper, part, yes. That,
yeah, the better, faster part. Well, it's cheaper to somebody else. That's well, for later. Get it done.
Talking about cheaper, I mean, vaccines are the best health investment anybody, any country can make for its population. For the cost of vaccine, what you're preventing in terms of morbidity, mortality, all the associated health costs with people, children that are sick, elderly that are sick, vaccines are by far away the best investment anyone can make in this area.
Dr. Ripley Ballew is the head of clinical research and translational science at GSK. More information is available on the web at gsk.com. Abeona Therapeutics focuses on a wide range of diseases. I asked Abeona's president, Dr. Tim Miller, to start with juvenile Batten disease. What is it?
Sure. So it's an inborn error of metabolism. These kids, they're born with it. They're usually diagnosed.
That's genetic induced.
Yes, it's genetic. And so they're diagnosed between the ages of 5 and 10 normally. When the kids are first diagnosed, it's usually from some changes in vision. They end up going blind. They have developmental delays and eventually end up, not reaching their, mid-20s.
And so they basically have some stretch of genes that aren't producing what they're supposed to be producing.
That's correct. These are considered lysosomal storage diseases. So there's an organelle in the cell that acts as kind of like the garbage factory. And it has an enzyme in it that's supposed to break down sugars. And these sugars can then be used by the rest of the cell for metabolism. And when they're born with this error, this genetic error, they can't break down those sugars. And so the cells kind of swell up. It kind of looks like an episode of Hoarders where they just can't get rid of the sugars that are in the cell.
And how many children are affected by this?
There are about 5,000 of them.
And now let's also talk about Sanfilippo.
Sure. So Sanfilippo syndrome, there are four different types, A, B, C, and D. We're focusing on gene therapies for the most common two, type A and type B. So those kids, it's also a lysosomal storage disease. They're diagnosed between the ages of 2 and 6. They have developmental delays, cognitive challenges, muscular issues. They can't sleep at night as they get older. 70% of the children with Sanfilippo don't reach their 18th birthday. All rare diseases.
Both of which are caused by genetic abnormalities, but in each case, a different part of the human genome.
That's correct.
Now let's enter the therapeutics you have.
Sure.
What do they do? It's like a single therapeutic, but used two different ways.
That's correct. So we're developing these genetically modified viruses to deliver the correct functioning copy of the gene. And so what we're able to do with a single injection, an intravenous injection, is deliver the correct copy of the genes to all organs of the body, but most importantly into the brain. Because these children have a lot of central nervous system issues, it's important that we're able to deliver this therapy into the CNS. And our particular therapy is the only one in the world, the only type, that has a virus that can get across the blood-brain barrier, which is a big challenge in these therapies.
I think one thing for us to realize is with conditions like this, is once there is a problem in the genes, it's a problem everywhere there's a cell in your body. It's not like there's a problem in your arm or your knee or your nose. It's everywhere there's a cell, and that is everywhere.
Yeah, no, that's correct. It's a truly devastating disease. The parents, they watch their kids. They're born, they look completely normal, and as they start to grow up, the parents recognize that there's some form of developmental delay, and it's a rare disease. So they have to have a pediatrician that's willing to help work through what the diagnosis is, and they eventually get a genetic diagnosis.
So in each case, you're going to use the virus to deliver a different stretch of new genes.
That's correct. The correct functioning copy of the gene that has the errors of metabolism.
So if you actually, and this sounds silly, but if you crossed over and gave one drug to the other, it just wouldn't matter.
Nope.
I already got those genes. I need different genes.
That's right.
Exactly. Okay, so you've got the mechanism. You have the idea and you have the kids. Where do you go from there? Where are you now?
So we are about to enter clinical trials. We've finished our preclinical development for one of the versions of Sanfilippo, and we're expecting to be able to enroll both trials towards the end of 2015. For juvenile Batten disease, we're working with our researchers and founders in the University of Nebraska and working to help them and anticipate starting clinical trials in 2016. We also have another program for treating Fanconi's anemia using one of the new gene editing strategies, the CRISPR-Cas9 system, which has received a lot of press recently.
Now tell us about that condition, and then we'll go to what CRISPR is doing for
Sure. So Fanconi's anemia, they have problems with their bone marrow about making blood cells. And they, you know, many of them end up developing forms of cancer. It's a large problem for these patients.
So that's sort of a follow-on to the problem. Another genetic disorder where you have
another genetic disorder. So we have four. So Abeona Therapeutics is working on four. And we're using this CRISPR-Cas9 system. We're also looking for other opportunistic targets, particularly for the blood disorders. But the CRISPR-Cas9 system is like molecular scissors, and they can go in and just cut out the genetic error and replace it with the correct functioning one.
The whole idea of a virus carrying additional genes into the body, which is what we're seeing in the treatment of Sanfilippo and juvenile Batten, where it's like as long as you get some of these, you'll be – some good stretches, you'll be able to produce the right proteins, that everything will be fine. This is different. In this second case here, you're saying we're going to correct the genes that are there in your body. We're going to change them. That's different.
That's different. And so it's the cutting edge of gene therapy right now. And so, you know, working with FDA regulators, working with, you know, the other companies in the same space, you know, we're all everyone's very excited about this technology with the potential for it. But certainly there are some things that still need to be worked out.
And what are you doing exactly with the CRISPR technology? What are you creating so that it will go in and literally change the DNA in place?
So what we've been able to demonstrate, what the founder out of University of Minnesota has been able to demonstrate, is that when he took cells out of a patient with Fanconi's anemia, he was able to correct them. So the idea would be that you could also put those back in once they've been corrected. With the CRISPR system, we're able to invade the cells with a virus, okay, go in, find where the defect is, cut it out, and put in tell the cell to make the correct functioning version.
So you're actually replacing the DNA in the
That's
cell.
That's correct.
Whereas for Sanfilippo and Batten, you were saying as long as we have the virus insert and we'll put these extra genes in there, it'll be able to produce the protein. Now you say, nah, we're correcting this.
That's correct. So it's a gene replacement strategy versus a gene editing strategy.
You're not out there at the edge, are you? Simple name Tim, simple name Miller, out there at the edge producing
right.
these kinds of therapies.
Well, it's an exciting time to be in gene therapy. And, you know, we originally were founded with the support of international foundations and the United States to find and fund, you know, these cures for these kids. There are no other FDA-approved therapies out there. And, you know, when they looked around and saw, you know, the therapies that were available, they chose this one as what they thought was best in class, is the best hope for their kids.
Now, let me ask you, Tim, how do you get the kids and how do you put these new therapies into them? This is tough.
Sure. So we have a natural history study ongoing with our collaborating institution, a Nationwide Children's Hospital in Columbus, Ohio, which is doing leading the world with intravenous gene therapies. They have a number of other gene therapy programs there. And so we have a natural history study that's ongoing where the families come in and the clinicians study the patients and find out what are important things to look at that could be potentially affected and measured by a treatment.
And then you have to sign your kid up.
That's true. And, you know, the parents have been very supportive. They're very much looking forward to the opportunity to have their kids receive a gene therapy.
Because there is no other option.
There's no other option. And, you know, with some of the other therapies that are in development, you know, a gene therapy delivered by intravenous, you know, it's relatively non-invasive. There's a very strong safety profile now. And really, you know, you always hesitate to use the word cure. But, you know, when you look around the field right now and some of the other competitors on comparable gene therapy companies, they're demonstrating that these gene therapies, a lot of them work, particularly for these single gene recessive disorders.
And, of course, you've got a lot of excitement going up. On Monday, you ring the bell at NASDAQ.
That's right. So we're changing. We have a new website and a new logo, and we were invited to come in and ring the closing bell at NASDAQ.
The closing bell.
Yep.
So any bell. Yeah, any bell is good. Any bell is good with
so
that.
So the company's very much looking forward to that. And we also just recently joined the Russell 3000 Business Index, so another milestone for the company.
And no pressure now. Now you got to perform, Tim.
Well, we have great faith in our clinicians and our scientists, And these therapies really are the wave of personalized genetic medicine for the future.
Dr. Tim Miller is the president and CEO of Abeona Therapeutics. More information is available on the web at abeonatherapeutics.com. That's Abeona, A-B-E-O-N-A, abeonatherapeutics.com. Now we turn from viruses to bacteria. David Williams is the managing director of Bactivo, which started in an earlier enterprise, Discova.
At Discova, we're focused on killing bacteria. So the technology we invented was to actually look inside bacteria and see how best to kill them. So we got an enormous amount of information on what bacteria are doing, and we thought, well, we could use that information to make bacteria do something that we want them to do, something useful. And in this case, it's to make new medicines.
And now, how do you go and take bacteria and make them useful after learning how to ask them to go away?
That's a really good question. And the technology, the key technology, is really hardwiring bacteria with enormous numbers of different mutations. And what that means is we can hardwire them to do all sorts of different things, every single thing they could possibly do. And one of those things is to make different compounds, new medicines.
Now, a lot of people are using all these, you know, genetic manipulation tools to modify and engineer, or as you say, hardwire a lot of things, including bacteria. How is what you're doing at Bactivo different?
Well, you couldn't have done this sort of thing 5 years ago. The technologies just didn't exist. So the advances in the ability to sequence huge amounts of information, DNA, is something that's relatively new. We have various nano microfluidic technologies. We have artificial intelligence algorithms that are extremely new. So all of these things together make a very, very unique offering at Bactivo.
But why bacteria? You can engineer anything with DNA.
I mean, that's absolutely right. A third of our medicines today come from natural product sources. But bacteria represent an enormous amount of diversity. So lots of different chemicals that they make. And the really good thing about bacteria is they're all around us. I can go outside this building and just dig up some soil, and there'll be thousands of different bacteria in there, all of which are producing something. And some of those things are really useful.
So the idea is that you go and you start to look at bacteria everywhere, which they outnumber us by. We don't even want to talk about it in this room.
That's
we're
right.
Crawling with bacteria.
Yep, yep.
And start to look at what's interesting about them.
That's right, yes. And the real key to what we do is we've developed techniques that enable us to genetically engineer these bacteria very quickly and very effectively. And what we manage to do to them is make them do everything that they could possibly do, everything that they contain. We modulate the genes, we downregulate them, we upregulate their expression so that each individual bacteria is doing something different. And the key to what we do is we then take that big mixture of bacteria doing things that are different and we screen them to look for a quality that's useful. So we'll put those against, for example, a diseased cell, and we'll see whether the bacteria cause that diseased cell to get better.
Or to change in any way.
Absolutely.
We know we're going to affect it. We might be able to do something else with it.
That's right. And the screening is a very key part of the technology because we can screen 70,000 events per second. It's a very fast screening technology. So we can literally screen through tens of millions of bacteria of these different genetic mutations to see what's doing something good.
Now, are you just trying to develop these bacteria on your own, or do you also help other companies do the same?
Yeah, we think it's a paradigm shift in how to make new medicines. So we couldn't possibly exploit this fully on our own. But what we're doing is we've got our own programs that we're pursuing, and we have partnerships with pharma companies. So we signed a collaboration earlier this year, which we can't disclose, but that's a relatively big one, and we're signing more as we go along.
And I'll believe that. Even though the company is unnamed, that you actually signed the agreement.
Yeah, absolutely.
You wouldn't lie to me because you got the bacteria on your side. But I think that speaks to the power of this. We're always trying to look for new things in new ways. And it's like, no, part of this deal is we want to make this agreement with you, but we don't want anybody to know about you.
That's right. I mean,
how we're using it.
Yeah. It's very interesting because to do that, when we did that deal, we were just talking informally to a pharma company about what the potential of the technology was. And we'd signed the deal several months later. It was a very quick deal. We didn't expect it.
Well, this is really interesting. So now you're on Biotech Nation and everybody's going to know.
Yes, absolutely.
Yes. We'll actually want to hear the first pharma company that is willing to say that they're working with you. That'll be a landmark. Now, I want to ask you, what particular conditions or diseases are you looking at with your own drug discovery?
Yeah, so one of the first disease indications that we're looking at is mitochondrial disease. So these are diseases, those collections of diseases that affect very small populations of people, but are devastating. So just having a small advantage in a compound is going to make a big difference to a patient's life.
And what kind of diseases would they be?
These are things like there are various central nervous system diseases. There are some muscle wasting diseases. There's a big collection of different diseases. Different mutations in the mitochondria give quite devastating symptoms.
And what could the bacteria do?
Well, the thing about bacteria is when they're in the soil, they're communicating with their friends and foes. So they're making some bacteria die and some bacteria grow better. So, for example, and bacteria are very like mitochondria. They're the sort of the prototype mitochondria is a bacteria.
The mitochondrial DNA, is that what you get from your mother?
Absolutely right. Yes, that's correct. But the thing about mitochondria is that there's a lot of similarities between mitochondria and bacteria. So we're pretty certain that there are compounds that bacteria produce that can make mitochondria better or worse, depending on what the disease is that we're trying to target. And in some mitochondrial diseases, you want to damp down the activity of the mitochondria, and some you want to upregulate it.
You know, we're just beginning to get that picture. We got it certainly earlier in breast cancer when we realized 25%, 30% of the tumors were caused by upregulation, overexpression of the HER2 gene. You begin to understand that regulating that DNA programming can change what's going on, and when it's for the worse or for the better, you're saying, let's see if we can't introduce bacteria that have that.
Yeah, and these are compounds that the bacteria are producing. And remember that bacteria have been evolving for something like 500 million years on the Earth. So these molecules that they're producing have had a lot of time to get good. So we're exploiting the power of evolution to identify these new molecules that will have phenotypic effects. They've evolved to interact with a load of different proteins, a load of different targets within the cells to have a function and an output. And that output, we think, is going to be useful in these diseases.
I love it. Finally, humans have gotten around to the point they have enough science and technology. They can say, oh, my goodness, look how smart these bacteria are. Look at how many of them. Let's go after them. We can use them.
Absolutely right.
David Williams is the managing director of Bactevo. More information is available on the web at Bactevo.com. That's Bactevo, B-A-C-T-E-V-O, Bactevo.com. For Biotech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
Tech Nation and its regular segment Biotech Nation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Mahler, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are productions of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Landcor.